Up next on the program, we welcome back to the show a great friend of Downtown, visits with us every month or so. He is a journalist and author of the book Futile and Stupid Gesture, Orson Welles expert, and just a genuinely great guy to talk to. We say hello to our friend Josh Karp. Well, hey. Good day, Mr. Karp. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right, thank you, for a man of my advanced years. I made it through most of the summer so far without significant injury, so that's good.
Good deal.
Are you doing any coaching this summer?
No, I finally have aged out of, or my kids have aged out of me coaching. I stop when they no longer, when the parents start caring about who wins and who loses. That's like the end of the line for me. I kind of, it's about the age of 10 or 11. My youngest is 13 now. So I got out of that business. But no, I loved it when I did it. Are you coaching?
I am not. No, my son hasn't started yet. We'll see what happens. He's so far, his level of involvement in anything is at the skim the surface level. He'll try stuff and then move on to something new. And then we're okay with that so far.
Oh, good deal. Yeah, no, it was, I almost got punched by an opposing coach who I tried to calm down for trying to calm him down. And I was like, okay, this is not going to last forever. So in terms of coaching, that was when I was like, okay, here's the cutoff.
Did he look at all like Vic Morrow?
No, you know, it was really funny. It was like one of those things where, you know, you never really, you know, you think, like, don't touch an angry person, but I figured, why not? And I, like, kind of put my hand on his shoulder and said, hey, why don't we just let this go? And all of a sudden I looked and he was rearing back like he wanted to hit me. And
Whoa.
He was a tiny little guy. And I was like, oh, boy. And I was like, okay, I'm done. I was like, game over. We're leaving. And he was like, what? And I'm like, you were going to hit me. And he's like, and so, yeah, he was not as scary as Vic Morrow.
Sport.
So that was good news.
Sport bringing out the best in people yet again.
Yes, of course. Yeah, no, that's, I went through a lot of hockey and a lot of baseball over the years. So I got to see all kinds of the huge range of human behavior.
All right. So I have to ask, have you had any success tracking down Gabe Kaplan?
Yes. Though we are in, I've been trying to get him to do an interview about his time on Battle of the Network Stars. We are corresponding, but we have not agreed to anything yet.
So, for anybody who doesn't know, the story is that apparently years after his famous matchup with Robert Conrad in Battle of the Network Stars, years later they got together for a dinner.
Right. Yeah. No. He wrote a great article about it. I'm dying to interview him about it. He wrote a terrific article about getting back together with him. I mean, I think like 40 years later, something like that, like shortly before Robert Conrad died. But that was, I think I may have said this before, but that moment was like my Kennedy assassination, the argument, or that episode of Battle of the Network Stars with him and Telly Savalas and Robert Conrad. It was never equaled again. That was really the high point of the Battle of the Network Stars, you know, listening to Howard Cosell talk about Scott Baio like he was a five-star athlete. It was great.
I tried. I had no luck. I tried and tried to track down Robert Conrad for a number of years. He was, for a while, doing some radio work wherever he lived
really?
At the end of his life, was doing, I think, a weekend radio show that was essentially just him telling stories about all of his adventures on and off screen, which would have been a great listen too, but I'm disappointed I never caught up with him.
Oh, I'll bet. He would have been great. He was a Chicago guy too, so he was always kind of a vague presence around these parts in terms of, you know, like, you know, with Chicago, we're always so kind of tribal about, you know, people who come from here. In fact, I was watching something with my kids and there was an actor and I was like, that guy's got to be from Chicago. I can tell by the way he talks, you know? And it's, Robert Conrad was always, you know, we always get kind of like the weird minor celebrities other than Bill Murray.
So who is the quintessential Chicago actor?
God, let me think now. Now I'm on the spot. You know, the guy who most sounds like a Chicagoan, who's not really famous, is that John Capelos, who's in a lot of the John Hughes movies. He plays he's the future brother-in-law in 16 Candles. He sounds the most like anybody from Chicago. Bill Murray, occupies such a huge space in everybody's psyche around here. And I live not far from the town where he grew up, so they're kind of an even larger presence around here. So he always kind of wins the Chicago thing because he shows up a lot. So
Capelos is Canadian. I had
more Chicago-y. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I can't believe Capelos is Canadian. I was just looking him up. I would never have guessed that.
Is he really?
Yeah.
He's not even from Chicago?
No, from London, Ontario.
Oh, my God. Now, that's depressing. He does a Chicagoan better than anybody I've ever seen.
he was the janitor in the Breakfast Club, right?
Yes, exactly.
Who had, exactly. I often quote him in talking with other teachers at school, his great line to the assistant principal, the aptly named Dick, when he said to him, the kids haven't changed, Dick, you've changed.
Have you found that to be true?
Oh, yeah. When people start complaining about how awful the kids are, I'm like, you know what? I've been doing this a while. They were pretty much the same 30 years ago. Circumstances might have changed a little bit.
I found that was probably the case. I taught journalism at Northwestern for a while, and I changed for sure. I think once I'd been there for 5 or 6 years, I started thinking all the students had changed, and probably in the end it was me. I started to realize what I was cut out for and what I wasn't, and what kind of once I had classes full of kids who had never heard of like Spiro Agnew, I started going like, oh boy, I'm too old to be to be around this place.
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I used to always ask kids the question, hey, go home and ask your parents where they were when Kennedy was assassinated. And it's been a while now, but I remember the first time I had a student come in and say, my parents weren't born when Kennedy was assassinated. And it was like a dagger right through the heart.
Absolutely.
So I'm not like, now I ask, do your parents remember when the Challenger exploded? The what? Never mind.
Right. it's gonna have to be September 11th pretty soon.
I think so. And that was strange, too. The first class I had that wasn't even alive on 9/11. That was bizarre to get used to.
Oh, my God. How strange is that? Yeah, no, that's incredible. Mm.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. I saw this thing the other day, and I thought of you immediately. What's up with Alec Baldwin and William Friedkin and their search for Orson Welles' cut of The Magnificent Ambersons?
You know, I do not know a ton about it, but I do know that there is a fairly well-funded effort to find this lost cut of The Magnificent Ambersons. I mean, that's the great thing. You know, it's funny. You would think, you know, at a certain point, people would stop seeking various, you know, Orson Welles treasures. But that's the great thing about him is that, you know, everything other than Citizen Kane, you know, came with a story about how, what it could have been had, you know, the people with the money not undercut it's almost impossible. I mean, you know, you can think of other directors where there are, you know, there's like, you know, one film where it's like, oh, you know, the director's cut was better. With Wells, there are, you know, unfinished projects. There are movies where, you know, he was not allowed to cut it the way he wanted to, you know, and people recut it, or, you know, there's just mountains of film. And so, yeah, the Amberson cut is, you know, considered, because Ambersons was going to be the movie that I think to some large extent was going to be greater than Citizen Kane.
Right.
And there is this, you know, like, it's one of the things I love about Orson Welles. There's this whole mystery around where's the cut that he made that the studio, you know, rejected while he was down in Brazil shooting a documentary. And so, yeah, no, it's one of the great mysteries, and that, you know, is something that, you know, the his vision. I think that's what the one common denominator with everything is. People are always looking for the thing that really fit his vision and wasn't undone by studios or undone by producers or whatever. So he, but yeah, I mean, you know, every other director, you know, may have one or two of those. He had like, you know, 20 of them.
Well, speaking of that, from your perspective, what's the best version of Touch of Evil?
Oh, you know, I like Touch of Evil as I've seen it, you know. I think, you know, the one with the you know, commonly shown. I mean, I haven't watched it in a long time, but I just, that's such a great movie, and it's such a great, you know, backstory, because, you know, that was, he made, that's a different, I'm thinking Lady of Shanghai with him picking up the book in a like corner store and,
oh, right.
Somebody, oh, I want to make the lady from Shanghai. But Touch of Evil, it's such a great movie, and it's such a, what's so great about it is that it's such a great B movie.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
That he raised, you know, he didn't try to make it something that it wasn't, and it was, you know, the B movie as an art form, and how he just, you know, did such a spectacular job of that. But he left behind so many stories that I think, you know, that I'll be dead and buried before they find everything that we're supposed to be seeing of him.
Touch of Evil, too, is one of my favorite Welles performances, because it's so without vanity. He is just, he's an awful, awful character in that in so many ways, but he's brilliant at it.
Oh, yeah, and I don't know, have you ever heard the story about him? There's a great story about how it's possibly, you know, something that he made up as life went on. But he claimed that when he was making Touch of Evil and he was back living in Hollywood, he had a party one night and he came home from the set and he still had all of his makeup on and the guests had arrived and everybody was going, God, Orson, you look terrific. Look at you. You're fantastic. Because everybody's so full of crap, you know, that they're just used to telling everybody they look great. And he had all this makeup on that made him look heavier and worse than he actually looked. But, you know, so yeah, that was his story of how full of it everybody in Hollywood was.
We interviewed recently a gentleman who wrote a book on the history of moonlighting, which was a wonderful book.
Wow.
And he had talked to just about everybody except Bruce Willis. But Sybil Shepherd told the story about the time that Welles nearly burned down the house she was sharing with Peter Bogdanovich because he had put a lit cigar into his robe and then forgotten about it. And so he set the robe down and boom, the next thing you know, there's smoke billowing out of his room.
Yeah, no, I the story, there has got to be a really good fictionalized version of that, of him living at Bogdanovich's house, to be made into a movie or a short story somewhere. Because, yeah, it was like the man who came to dinner, except for real, and 10 times crazier. I mean, that was, you know, he basically, you know, Bogdanovich had really made it, and he had this production company, the director's company, that was worth a ton of money, and it was kind of his moment at the peak, and Orson moved into his house. You know, he let him use the house while he was out of the country shooting. And when Bogdanovich and Sybil Shepherd came back, Orson had turned it into his house and a studio. And he was basically shooting The Other Side of the Wind there. And he was occupying 90% of the house. And Peter and Sybil were cramped into this little corner of this mansion in Bel Air. And he was, you know, I think Sybil Shepherd, I recall telling me the story, you know, she said, Orson, you know, when she came down and, you know, said something about the fire, you know, he said, oh, nothing's happening. You know, he got all huffy and he accused her of eating all the fudgesicles. Just great. When he very clearly was the one who ate all the fudgesicles. I always love that. He always was, you know, there were always stories about Orson, you know, like he didn't eat in front of people often, but he would, you know, eat, you know, 10 bags of Fritos behind the scenes and then accuse Sybil Shepherd of eating all the Fritos or eating all the fudgesicles, which I just love. Somebody once said that they said, you know, he could tell you a story and he knew he was lying. You knew he was lying and he knew you knew he was lying, but you just had to believe it as the absolute truth and accept it because it was Orson Welles. You know, he was just so good at, you know, kind of creating all this drama around whatever was happening in his life.
We lost a great actor since the last time you and I spoke. For my money, there wasn't anybody better when it comes to character actors in the 70s and 80s and beyond than Ned Beatty. I don't know that he ever had a bad performance.
Oh, he is fantastic. I love Ned Beatty. I mean, that scene in Network honestly like one of the great scenes in all film history. And I recall reading a book about Network by, I think, David Itzkoff. And he talks about that scene. And I think Ned Beatty, like, he flew in for one day, you know, so he had no, you know, he was just kind of dropped into that picture, came in, shot that scene and flew out. And oh, he was fantastic. He was such a good actor. And yeah, he's like one of those guys like Charles Durning, you know, and then at Walsh also, you know, no movie was ever anything but better for their appearance.
Years ago, maybe 35 or so years ago now, I met him briefly and chatted with him a little bit, and he told me, and I, you know, maybe he was making it up, but he seemed sincere. He told me that the idea of his famous squealing like a pig in Deliverance, that was his idea, and he suggested it to John Borman.
Really? That's, wow. That, I'm still traumatized from that.
Oh, yeah, who isn't? Yeah.
That was back when, you know, parents were like, yeah, we're going to see Deliverance, you know, and let's bring along the 7-year-old, I was.
What a good idea.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the great things. I remember my grandfather taking me at the age of 9 to see Dog Day Afternoon. And I think that probably, you know, had some kind of psychological impact I'll never understand.
You see, Josh getting home and Josh gets home and every time he doesn't get his way, he's screaming, Attica!
Oh, right. Yeah, no, it was funny as I really, watching it, you know, that there was a lot of swearing, so I thought it was hilarious. It was like Bad News Bears to me. And then all of a sudden it got serious real fast.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa. But yes.
That's funny. Somebody posted the other day on social media. What was the most inappropriate movie you saw because you were too young at the time?
Right, that would be mine. I mean, I honestly think I was maybe 9 when he took me to see that. And I mean, you just know, you know, it pales in comparison to my uncle taking me to see The Longest Yard, which was oddly appropriate compared to that. But yeah, I never got over Dog Day Afternoon. That was too much for even me at the age of 7 or 8 or whatever I was.
I went to see, it was a World War II movie, and I want to say it was The Bridge at Remagen. And I think I was maybe 11, and my grandfather took me to see it because he'd been in World War II, and we're going to go see a war movie, great moment. And then in the middle of the movie, an actress takes off her shirt, and I'm seeing that for the first time in my young life. And, you know, I wanted to enjoy it, but I was so uncomfortable, and I didn't dare look to my left to see what my grandfather was doing until he leaned over, and I don't know to this day if it made it better or worse. He said, pretty nice, huh?
That's my, I years ago, this is not that many years ago, maybe about 6 or 7 years ago, we were on a vacation, and we were renting a house. I went out to pick up some groceries, and I came back, and one of my kids is a hockey player, and my wife said, "Oh, you know, I decided to put on a hockey movie for them." And I started thinking,
"Oh no,
if it's not Mighty Ducks or Miracle, we're in trouble." And sure enough,
Slapshot.
My wife had put Slapshot on.
Oh yes!
And I walked in, and there was my father-in-law watching Slapshot with the kids, who were, I think, our oldest was 13, and down to the age of 6. And they're watching with my father-in-law, and I just kind of went, I got to go take a nap. I'm not going to stop it. I'm just not going to be here while it happens.
All right, I'll let you navigate this. Good luck.
Yeah, I was like, you've made a mistake, and you will live with the result of your mistake.
Oh, man, that is awesome. Hey, what's going on with you and Ricky Cobb? I know you've been working on an encyclopedia of the 70s. Is that still a work in progress?
Yeah, Ricky, so we're working on that. We're hoping to have that ready to go by fall.
Oh, wow.
It's mostly going to be, I think the second book is going to be the Encyclopedia of the 70s. The first one is going to be really a compilation of Ricky's Super 70s tweets along with some additional material, some Legends of the 70s type of, Bert Convy and people like that. interspersed between, collection of the best of his tweets. And he and I are working on an animated series, which in the future I'll be able to talk about more. But we're working on an animated series kind of set somewhat in the world of Super 70s sports.
Oh, wow.
And that's been going really well. So, yeah. So, Rick, one of the greatest thing about the pandemic was that Ricky and I wound up collaborating on stuff.
That's fantastic. Well, listen, if you need any mediocre voice talent for that animated project, you know where to find me.
You got it. We'll come for you.
Excellent. Hey, Josh, it's always good to talk with you. Appreciate you making time for us today, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you. You too, and I'll talk to you soon.